Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, I often think about the fall of Rome and Greece and Egypt and Iran or Persia and the Mayans. I mean, look at those countries and people today, constantly struggling economically, politically, and socially, and compare them to the shining civilizations they once were. Same people, very different reality. What happened? And then look around at our society. I hate to sound maudlin here, but for at least 30 years, I've thought that we're seeing the fall of Rome in something like quintuple time. Things are falling apart in every area. Everybody recognizes this nowadays, but there doesn't seem to be anything we can do to stop this downward spiral. My guest today is one of the world's leading experts on why societies prosper or fail. Maybe he can shed some light on this. A little introduction is in order. I'll tell you, many of my guests over the years have been extraordinary people, but my guest today is possibly extra extraordinary. Dr. Jared Diamond is a professor of geography at UCLA. He began his scientific career in physiology and expanded into evolutionary biology and biogeography, kind of a mouthful. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences and has been awarded the National Medal of Science, among many other distinguished honors. Perhaps you've heard of the MacArthur Foundation Fellowships, which are sometimes called the Genius Award. He's one of those. He's published more than 600 scholarly articles, and his book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, won the Pulitzer Prize. So I guess he might know what he's talking about. Welcome, Dr. Diamond.
It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Thanks so much for being on with us. Can we call you Jared?
Please do, yes.
That's great. I can tell this is going to be one of those shows for which I will wish we had a lot more than half an hour, but let's plunge in. One of your books, called Collapse, is subtitled How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed. And it's something that National Geographic made a documentary film about a little while back. And the keyword in that subtitle to me is choose. Choose to fail or succeed. What do you mean by that?
By that I mean that the collapses of societies or the successes of societies usually are not predetermined. It's not the case that whenever a society collapses, it's because an asteroid crashed in and there was nothing that society could do about it. Instead, societies face problems which they may meet in adequate ways or inadequate ways, such as the United States today. The U.S. has problems. They're not problems that doom us. The question is whether we're going to choose to solve our problems. And that's why my subtitle was How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed.
Okay, so you think there is choice involved and free will in a sense? I mean, it's not just an organic thing that societies like human bodies age and in various ways obsolesce and collapse. It's not like that. There is a choice that societies can make?
Absolutely. Yeah, sometimes people talk about a metaphor of societies having lifespans like human lifespans and collapse being inevitable. But no, there are societies that have gone on for a long time. Chicopean society in the Southwest Pacific has gone on for several thousand years. Japan has had no major collapse, except for its brief military defeat at the end of World War II, over the last 14,000 years. Iceland has done very well for 1,000 years. So no, there's no lifespan of societies and nothing inevitable about collapse.
Well, there are obviously many factors at play in a societal collapse. It's not just, I guess, from what you're saying, a matter of having it so easy that you become weak and then a stronger, hungrier society overruns you, which I think probably most people tend to think is what happens. So what are some of the other variables?
Well, some of the other variables, if I started out by saying there's one overriding factor, you should immediately tell me, let's stop talking, you're an idiot.
If I told
you there were 85 factors, you would say that's true, but you are useless, so let's stop talking.
Okay.
I've reduced it to 5 major factors. One factor, obviously, is the ecological damage that a society imposes on its surroundings, something about which I, as a Californian, know and think a lot now because of the problems that Californians are causing themselves. Climate change is another thing that immediately springs to mind for us today, and it's operated in the past. Hostile neighbors or hostile other countries are very much on our mind today, and they have been in the past, such as when the Roman Empire faced the barbarians. Decreasing support from friends, from allies, has been a problem in the past. And finally, responses, how a society responds or fails to respond. There's an explanation with 5 useful factors rather than one useless or 85 useless ones.
So that was a pretty concise list, as you said. Why don't we maybe pick a couple and give some examples. For example, environmental disasters or environmental problems, what are some good examples in history of societies collapsing from that particular reason?
Sure. An example of a society that collapsed where environmental factors played a role was the collapse of the Khmer Empire of Cambodia, based on what's now Angkor, the wonderful temple ruins in Southeast Asia. Angkor was, for many centuries, the most powerful political entity in Southeast Asia, and it eventually declined, partly due to self-inflicted environmental problems. Namely, they needed lots of wood for this huge city. They deforested the surrounding hills, and with deforestation, when rain fell, it then caused flooding without trees to hold back the rain. In the case of Angkor, that self-inflicted environmental damage combined with climate change. Climate change delivered the last blow to a society already weakened by its environmental problems. Those are two explanations, again, very familiar to us Americans today, because we're facing self-inflicted environmental problems, but we're very aware of climate change.
You know, the thing you're describing in Cambodia with the collapse of the Khmer Society due to the deforestation and so on reminded me of Haiti, even in modern times, you know, even now. And then in its neighbor, I mean, the Dominican Republic and Haiti, as you know, split the island of Hispaniola. And if you fly over, you can see such a clear demarcation between the two sides. And the Dominican Republic is stable and pretty healthy. And, you know, so there's the environmental issue is very pressing on the Haitian side. Now, Haiti was never a glowing society like some of the ones we've been describing here. But still, there's such a difference. It's like a test tube kind of case in a way of comparing those two. Is there an easy way to summarize the difference in those two sides of the island?
Yes, Haiti and the Dominican Republic share the island of Hispaniola, a Caribbean island near Cuba and Jamaica. A way to summarize the difference is to say what you see from the air and what many of the people with us now have seen from the air. If you fly from New York or Miami to Santo Domingo, capital of the Dominican Republic, you fly over the most amazing border in the world. It's a sharp line, green on one side and brown on the other side.
Right.
The green is the eastern side, the Dominican Republic. The brown is the western side, Haiti. Haiti sadly deforested the Dominican Republic with largely intact forests. And the deforestation of Haiti and the resulting soil erosion and running out of fuel is a large part of the reason why Haiti is now the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. There are reasons, there are historical reasons, why the Haitians deforested their half of the island, but the result is still this massive deforestation and crippling poverty that resulted from it.
So I was guessing that the deforestation, et cetera, was more like a symptom of the, I guess, the fifth reason you cited, which is political, economic, and social institutions that have problems, and so maybe those are more deleterious or more intense on the Haitian side of the island, and probably it's a complicated subject to get into, but would you agree that those are the underlying problems that cause the, let's say, the symptom of deforestation and so on the Haitian side?
Yes, what you've just said is 80% of the answer. The people of Haiti and the people of the Dominican Republic responded differently to their environments for historical reasons associated with the fact that Haiti was a slave colony, rich in the past, and the Dominican Republic was a non-slave colony, rather poor, of Spain. On top of that different response for historical reasons,
There
were also environmental differences, namely that the Haitian side is drier, steeper, and more ecologically fragile.
Hmm.
So that's why I say it's 20% ecology and 80% human response.
Let's take one more example before we leave the examples, because I think they're interesting. And, you know, everybody kind of has a general idea about the barbarians overrunning Rome and that being the cause of that. But maybe there was an underlying set of causes preceding that, right? But let's look at the Mayans, for example. Do we know what caused the decline and almost disappearance of that great culture? I mean, there are still Mayan people there, but they're nothing like the Mayans that ruled that civilization.
I would say we know. There are archaeologists who make a career out of saying that we don't know. But it's clear that what's called classic southern lowland Mayan civilization did collapse. Maya civilization went on in other areas, such as the north of the Yucatan Peninsula. It's also clear that the collapse came at the time of a massive drought. This was in a difficult terrain, limestone terrain, where it was difficult to get enough water for agriculture and other purposes. The collapse was widespread. It covered virtually the entire southern lowlands. An area that had been densely populated was virtually empty of people when Cortes marched through there in the 1500s. So it's a dramatic collapse. Yes, the Mayans did things. The Mayans fought with each other. They failed to unify. They failed to solve their environmental problems, which were very difficult ones. But the underlying cause was deforestation, problems of land management that were really difficult, and then this severe drought that went on for a couple of centuries.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Professor Jared Diamond, who is a professor of geography, actually a biogeographer, I guess, at UCLA in California, from where he is joining us today. And we're talking about his sphere of research, which is on why societies collapse, and then kind of the flip side is why they sometimes prosper. So you define societal collapse, I read this, as a drastic decrease in human population size and or political, economic, social complexity over a considerable area for an extended time. But I would think that Greece and Italy, for example, have higher populations and greater complexity today than they did 2,000 years ago. Are they the same societies or just kind of extended, less shining civilizations than they once were at those times a long time ago?
Greece and Italy are still in the same place on planet Earth today as they were 2,000 years ago. The modern Greeks and modern Italians are the descendants of the ancient Greeks and ancient Italians.
Mm-hmm.
Both Greece and Italy underwent declines. Italy is a relatively wealthy country today, and Greece by world standards also. So what you say makes the point that collapse is not forever, and solving of problems is not forever. Societies that have collapsed in the past can rise again and become strong, and societies that have been strong in today and in the recent past can also decline. So there's no incompatibility between the flourishing of Italy and Greece today and the decline that both went through a couple thousand years ago.
In fact, now that I think of it, are there any examples of societies that collapsed and then were completely wiped out, where there are not modern descendants of those people in that place?
One dramatic example is Norse Greenland. The Vikings, who were famous for raiding Europe and settled Iceland and then settled Greenland around the 800s and 900s, the Vikings carried on in Greenland with a society that built a cathedral and traded with Norway and assisted by dairying for 500 years, and eventually it died out. Every single Viking ended up dead, and Greenland was taken over by the Inuit. So there's a society that vanished completely. There are some small Polynesian societies, such as the Polynesian Society of Pitcairn Island, where every single person ended up dead. There are societies where people left. In the case of Pitcairn Island, whereas on Henderson Island, it's pretty clear that everybody ended up dead. Pitcairn Island, the people might have abandoned. But at any rate, yes, there are societies that disappeared completely.
Well, it sounds like it's fairly rare, though. It sounds like, really, when you talk about the collapse of a society, pretty much it loses its power and influence and its social aggregation, maybe, and then becomes a weaker, kind of degenerate version of what it once was, let's say. Maybe it sounds like that's the more common mold, then, I suspect, huh?
Yes, you're absolutely right about that. A large society, if you've got a million people, it's really going to take something to kill off every one of them, and I don't know any examples.
Hmm.
The examples of complete disappearance are Norse Greenland with about 5,000 people, Pitcairn Island, a few hundred people, Henderson Island, maybe 50 people. The complete disappearances are of very small societies.
You talked earlier about the influence of climate change as one of the factors that lead to collapse, but today, what we see in climate is a change that's accelerated over past climate cycles, and probably almost certainly, obviously, by the impact of human activities. So is it a bigger factor now? Among those five things that you listed, is climate change likely to be a bigger factor now than it was in the past?
Climate change certainly is a bigger factor now than it was 30 years ago. 30 years ago, we didn't talk about climate change. Scientists didn't recognize clearly climate change, or those few who recognized it faced a majority of scientists who were not yet convinced of its reality. And it's taken a while for scientists to become convinced that the major reason for the climate change that's going on now is the effect of humans. There has been, of course, climate change in the past, the beginning of glacial eras, the end of glacial eras. That had nothing to do with humans. What's different today is that the climate change is about 1,000 times faster than peak rates of climate change in the past. and that today the climate change is due to human effects, whereas in the past there weren't enough people and they weren't causing enough havoc to the environment to change climate, certainly not on a global scale.
Right. Having said that, are there societies there, maybe in Africa, I don't know, that are in the process of collapsing due to climate change in a more rapid way than they otherwise would have been in the past, do you think, as a geographer?
Well, let's stay much closer to home. Here I am in California.
Right.
The breadbasket of the United States is the Central Valley of California, which begins about 50 miles north of where I'm sitting now. At present, a significant fraction, maybe a quarter, third, half, of the farmland in the Central Valley is not being farmed because of climate change. Namely, there isn't enough water. It doesn't mean that American agriculture is collapsing or is going to collapse, but this is an example of one of the world's most productive agricultural systems under severe strain because of climate change.
So by the same token, I think you can almost say it's an analogy with warfare. Local wars used to be small and contained and local. And now local wars can, as we see, can rapidly escalate worldwide. And heaven help us, if they're nuclear, they could cause all human societies to collapse, right? Not just the combatants themselves. So one of your factors is warfare among neighbors or whatever. But in the past, that was a contained thing, and now it's potentially something that could cause worldwide collapse, right? So is that something that factors into your thinking?
It certainly does. We've had two world wars. Before 1914, there was never a world war. Big wars of the past, the War of Rome versus Carthage, and the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta. Those were big wars of history, but big wars of very local history.
Hmm.
The Chinese, the Maya, didn't know anything about what was going on in the Roman Empire. So today, because of our globalized world, wars can be worldwide. Among the risks to world stability that I see, one of the four big risks is obviously the risk of nuclear war, which could happen in various ways. 20 years ago, the big risk of nuclear war was between the major players, notably between the United States and Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And we still have to be concerned about the U.S. and Russia or the U.S. and China. But a bigger risk of nuclear war today is a local nuclear war, prime examples being North Korea, or an even bigger example, India and Pakistan,
right,
both armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons.
Hmm.
But if there were a nuclear war between India and Pakistan, each having something like more than 100 nuclear weapons, if each of them dumps its 100 nuclear weapons on the other, that's enough radioactivity and atmospheric effect to produce worldwide consequences and not just killing a billion or so Indians and Pakistanis.
Or Iran, potentially, and Israel. You know, there are a variety of local wars that could end up destroying the world. So that's a scary thought, which we've all had our whole lifetimes, but it seems to be more prominent nowadays than it was in the past. Well, let's see. You know, one thing, again, on your list of five things, wouldn't you include a sharp decline in social cohesion as a form of collapse? I mean, even in our society today, I mean, look at families and politics, you know, it's things, I don't know, maybe it's because of media, we see things more intensely now than we see the past. Someone like you who studies the past probably sees the past more clearly than most people do. But I guess that's the question. Wouldn't a form of collapse be the dissolution of social cohesion to a sharp degree?
Yes, indeed. And I suspect that you've either read an op-ed piece that I've written or that you are reading my mind. It is true that social cohesion is one of the issues under response that make response of societies essentially a wastebasket category for me. Into that category of response go all the social, economic, etc. reactions by a society. One of what I see as the four big problems of the United States today is exactly what you mentioned, the decline of social cohesion, the increased political breakdown of compromise, just the increasing nastiness, the increasing danger in the United States, of which we've seen some examples. As for the reason why the United States is having a worse breakdown of compromise than other countries, than, say, European countries or Japan, one can only speculate. The possible reason is what you and I are doing now. Namely, we are conversing, although you and I are not seeing each other face to face. And if one converses not face-to-face but with cell phones and computers and other things, if you don't see a person's face, it's easier to be nasty and insulting than when you've got a live human being a foot or two from you. So my guess is that a partial reason for the breakdown of social cohesion in the United States is the switch from face-to-face communication to non-face-to-face communication. But that then raises the question, why isn't the same breakdown going on in Europe and Japan that are equally addicted to cell phones?
Mm-hmm.
So that's an unanswered open question.
Yeah, that's a big big topic. We could easily do two more shows just on that, I suspect. But yeah, I didn't read your op-ed piece, by the way, so it was invented here, so I guess I was reading your mind. But anyway, or we're thinking alike one way or the other. So you just talked about technology, and I did a show, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, I guess, on, I think the title was The Internet, Good or Bad or something, and the idea was, is it a net benefit or a net evil, in effect, in the world? And so being older and remembering very well a world without the Internet, I had two guests on who were both young, very Internet-savvy entrepreneurs. And so in the end, I had a vote. So the two of them predictably voted that that the Internet was a net good thing for the world. And I said, listing all the factors, you know, and weighing them out, to me it was a net negative. And but I was in the minority, being old, in that vote. But so my question would be, what role does technology play in modern society as a threat to societies that it didn't play in the past? And that's what you were just starting to get into, so maybe it's kind of redundant, but is it mainly that it causes alienation, to put it in a nutshell?
An honest, simple answer would be that technology is increased power. Increased power is morally neutral. Increased power can be used for good things, it can be used for bad things. Increased power can be used to make atomic bombs that can kill 100,000 people within a very short time. Increased power can also be used to fuel our first world style of life. So today when people talk about technology and they ask, is the overall balance of technology good or bad? My response would be, for heaven's sakes, that's like asking about marriage. Is marriage overall good or bad?
Mm-hmm.
Marriage can cause the greatest misery that we are going to experience. Marriage can also cause the greatest joy that we're going to experience. And similarly, technology can be used either for the good or the bad. That's our choice.
Right. You know, it's subjective, and it's in the eye of the beholder, for sure. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Jared Diamond, who is a professor of geography at UCLA. And we're talking about his research, which is on why societies collapse. So another thing, what about overpopulation in and of itself? I mean, we talked about Haiti, for example. You know, doesn't it drive some of the other factors that you say lead to collapse just when the density of population gets too intense for the land, for the environment, and where a population lives?
Yes, certainly. The effects of people on the environment are proportional to the number of people multiplied by the amount of impact or damage that each of those people causes. 20 or 30 years ago, people used to talk, many of my friends used to say, the biggest threat to the world is population.
Hmm.
Well, now we know better. We know that the impacts of humans on the world are the product of two things, the number of people times the amount of resources that each of those people is consuming or the amount of waste that each of those people is putting out. So, for example, there are people who say, isn't it a big problem for the world that the population growth rate, that family size is 8 children in Kenya and Rwanda, and therefore aren't those Kenyans and Rwandans one of the biggest problems for the world today? And my response is, yes, it's sad for Kenya and Rwanda that their population growth rates are so high, but the impact of Kenya and Rwanda on the rest of the world is negligible because the living standard there is so low,
mm-hmm.
and the consumption rates and the wage production rates are so low. The average American and European and Japanese consumes 32 times more resources, puts out 32 times more waste than does the average inhabitant of the developing world. So I'm much more worried about the impact of us 320 million Americans. I'm even more worried about the impact of the 700,000 Icelanders on the world than I am on the impact of the 30 million Kenyans, because 30 million Kenyans, yes, cause problems for Kenya, but they don't cause problems for the world. They just don't consume enough and put out enough waste.
your latest book, Jared, The World Until Yesterday, was published in 2012. It's about your extensive time in New Guinea, Papua New Guinea, over the past 50 years or so, and what you've learned about the people there. So what does the title mean, The World Until Yesterday?
The title means that humans have been living in traditional ways ever since the separate origins of human species about 6 million years ago. We've been living traditionally, meaning living in very small societies without centralized government, without advanced technology. And in the modern world, there are still a lot of these small tribal societies left, notably in New Guinea and in the Amazon basin. Relatively recently measured by 6 million years, within the last few thousand years, societies in many parts of the world have developed centralized government and dense populations and writing and metal tools. But that's recent. That's why I talk about the world until yesterday, mm-hmm. the traditional world.
Okay.
Traditional people face the same problems that the rest of us do, like raising children and growing old. They have some good solutions to those problems from which I've learned a lot.
Okay, fascinating. The title again is The World Until Yesterday. All right, so we just have a minute or so left, Jared, and this is something that might take more than a minute to answer, but have some past societies staved off impending collapse? And if so, how do they do it?
Yes, indeed. There are past societies that staved off impending collapse. Japan is a good example. Densely populated society, but it's been going strong for at least 14,000 years. Or Iceland, a smaller population, facing severe environmental problems in the volcanic environment, but the Icelanders figured out how to manage their really difficult environment. And the Tikapian Islanders, Polynesians in the Southwest Pacific, again, a tiny environment, difficult to manage, but they learned how to micromanage their environment. So yes, there are past societies that figured out how to manage their environments. The challenge for us Americans today is to manage our American environment. Challenge for people in the world, this channel, is to manage the world environment. And we know how to do it. We know that we have to reduce our consumption rates. We know how to reduce our consumption rates. What's missing is the political will. And so that's why I come back to it's our choice.
And we are really about out of time. But if you, this is maybe an unfair question, but if you step back and look at the whole forest and not the trees, what do you see as the prospects for us in the U.S.? And I'll include Western Europe. Are we headed for a train wreck, for doom? Or are we likely to muddle along for another several centuries or whatever? Just if you can give a simple answer to that, and I don't know if it's a fair question.
I can give a simple answer to that. We will not muddle along for 300 years. We've got 30 years either to solve our problems or fail to solve them.
Wow.
I rate the chances as 52% that we will solve our problems and have a happy ending, and 48% that we will have an awful mess and the world won't be worth living in. Whether we get the 52% depends upon the choices that we make.
Wow, so you sound like I started off apologizing for being maudlin. We kind of agree on that, I think. So
yes.
All right. Well, everyone, to learn more and read about Dr. Jared Diamond's books and research, go to www.jareddiamond.org. So it's J-A-R-E-D and then diamond like the jewel, .org. Jared, I appreciate you being on with us. It's been very interesting.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks so much again, and thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.